Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. The last several years have seen a year-over-year increase in book banning. People are coming out of the woodwork to demand that schools and libraries remove books that might make their children uncomfortable, make them ask difficult questions, or might even provide them straight-up pornography. Funny story, though, these book banners seem to be a majority cisgender heterosexual white group of people, and the books they're targeting are almost exclusively books written by or about people of color and the LGBTQ community. Funny how that works. These attempts to silence minority groups from telling our own stories have a number of real-world impacts. They directly impact not only our current sales, but future acquisitions at publishers. They impact children's desire to read because kids are far more likely to read if the characters look like them, and in the absence of that representation, they read less. It's also impacting how publishers and distributors behave behind the scenes. Maggie Takuta Hall is a children's and young adult author who writes stories that help kids of all ages see themselves on the page as the main character. She also writes books that help parents and kids have age-appropriate conversations about the world we live in. One of those books, Love in the Library, became the center point for exposing a long-time issue with a major children's publisher and book distributor about the practice of quietly asking authors to censor themselves in exchange for visibility and placement. Maggie is also one of the founders of Authors Against Book Bans, an organization I'm proud to be a member of. We had a discussion about the importance of diverse books, the future of publishing, and mermaids. Maggie Takuta Hall, welcome back to Head on Fire. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
You are becoming a frequent guest. I'm shocked and surprised that you know who I am. So thank you so much for coming back.
I'm just glad to be invited.
For people who don't know you or your work, tell people a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Yeah, I'm Maggie Takuta Hall. I'm a children's and young adult book author. I have a new book out right now called The Worst Ronin. That's a young adult graphic novel. And I'm also one of the founding members and on the national leadership team for a new group called Authors Against Book Bans, which is seeking to organize authors in the response to the rising culture of book bans.
I love it. I listen. Since last we got to speak here on the podcast, you have had quite the literary journey. I think the last time we talked, we were promoting The Mermaid, The Witch, and the Sea. So it's been a minute, and you've had a lot of stuff come out since.
Yeah, that's true.
including the sequel to that book, which I was so happy about because I loved. I don't know if I ever told you this. The Mermaid, The Witch, and the Sea was like the first. I had been like an audiobook and sometimes ebook reader for years. I just had never had enough time to like slow down. And I remember The Mermaid, The Witch, and the Sea was the first like physical book that I needed to sit out on my porch and physically read. I loved it so much. It was such an interesting story. So you've had The Siren, The Song, and The Spy, which is the sequel to Mermaid. Yes. And you just had The Worst Ronin come out a few days ago. What's it like to be booked and busy and being Maggie Takuta Hall?
Gosh, rumors of my busyness have been exaggerated. it feels great. Feels fantastic. My skin's never been better. I'm hydrated. I'm moisturized.
So, you know, YA fantasy, queer fantasy especially, has seen a boom in recent years.
Yeah.
You write in that space almost exclusively. What do you think makes that world of fantasy so intriguing to young audiences?
I mean, I know when I was a teen, I gravitated toward it because I was kind of aware that adults were lying most of the time. And I feel like fantasy just sort of strips away the pretense about that and is like, right, it's all fucking make-believe. Go for it. And I appreciate that as a writer. I liked it as a reader. And I do think that often we can ask a more pointed question in a world without every single layering complication of our own sort of like intersectional complex reality. And fantasy can kind of be a cipher for understanding the real world. And it can also be a place where safer and happier paths are forged for people that are not afforded them usually. And I don't know, there's that G.K. Chesterton quote of dragons are exciting, like something to the effect of like dragons.
It's often attributed to Gaiman and
G.K. Yeah. Chesterton, because it's at the beginning of Coraline. So everyone thinks he wrote it despite having attributed it.
Yes.
But like, they exist because it's a story we can tell about how we beat them.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very intriguing. And that's that quote specifically too for how I thought about writing The Siren, The Song, and The Spy and trying to reimagine dragons as something other than just a weapon of mass destruction. Like the idea of what can power be, what if it is not just a means to destroy other people, was really exciting and fun for me. And I love getting to work in a space where all of those things are possible and where people have been asking complicated and difficult questions for so long. Like it's such a mature genre at this point. And so I really enjoy being there.
You know, I grew up reading a lot of stories that I definitely think would be considered YA fantasy at this point. I think YA is such a new term.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's in the late 90s, early, like mid-90s is like really.
Was it even 90s? I thought it was the 2000s. I mean, I thought it was even.
Yeah, it's like it's pretty recent and it's definitely in our lifetime. When we were kids, it didn't exist.
No, no. I read a lot of books that would have been categorized as YA, but I think that we've even started to become very precious with what YA is. And I think, I don't know, there was this movement to like expand YA to make it this, I don't know, maybe because adults were reading it because of the pacing. A lot of people want that like fast paced stuff that you get with YA. So a lot of all ages readers invaded YA spaces and then it expanded and now it seems to be contracting.
Yeah.
Do you think our sensibilities have changed as to what kind of stories we think are appropriate for kids? For, I mean, because you've written middle grade, is that right?
No, I've never written middle grade.
Oh, okay. You've written children's books. So I didn't.
I've gone younger than middle grade. And then once they're in elementary school, like third, fourth, fifth grade, I'm like, you're on your own. And then once they're in middle school, I'm back.
But the thing is, I think that you occupy a unique space then, because your children's books do not talk down to kids. So I'm just wondering, what are your views on that kind of infantilizing of kids, like what kids can handle, the stories that we give kids? Do you think that, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, so complicated. That's such an interesting question. And I feel like my mind goes in like four different directions at once with that question. Like, yes, it is absolutely true that we are really squeamish about telling kids hard truths about the world. And I really resent that. And I do think that we underestimate like the great capaciousness of children's minds and their wisdom and their ability to hold emotional complexity is something that we forget when we become adults, because we want to protect them, because we love them, and we never want the world to hurt them. And I totally understand where that comes from, but we set them up for so much more pain later in their life when we are not just sort of frank with them about the nature of the world, which is that it's not fair and that cruelty exists, and that, you know, there are systems of oppression in place that unfairly impact some people more than others, and that some of us are born with great luck and others are not, and it's no merit of their character. That being said, I also think that like the invading army of romance readers who came into the young adult space in the wake of Twilight and Hunger Games really did a disservice to the genre, because they have such a greater buying power. And that's why we see every single protagonist in YA is like 17 and up and basically an adult who's just not allowed to drink yet, but does anyway.
Who for some reason also has the body of a 28-year-old that has never spent a day outside of the gym. Like they,
yeah, like they're all fit, perfect, great. No, yeah. Like, and that's irrelevant to actual teens' lives as well. And I think there's a space for that, and those books deserve to exist. And I write some of them, and like, that's great. That upper YA is a category that deserves respect and space to exist. but it shouldn't be the only thing that exists in the genre just because the buying power of adults is greater than the buying power of children. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I understand the resentment, but to me, it's not a question of like, well, what are you not allowed to say in the younger YA? It's more a question of like, what is actually germane to a 12-year-old's life? Like that, and it could still be some of these really complicated, big, terrible things that we feel squeamish about talking to children about, but it might not be getting a job, and it might not be like having sex for the first time. Like, those are wonderful stories and they deserve to exist. But right now we see capitalism as just sort of like pushed actual like 12 to 15 year old concerns like completely out the window. And then we wonder why those kids are not as engaged with reading. And it's like, right, because they go from being like Rick Riordan readers to like nothing. Like, we don't have really anything for them.
Well, and you bring up a very good point that adults have the money. And so therefore mm-hmm. they think, well, okay, well, I'm going to decide what my money, you know, what books my kids read. I'm the one with the power. I'm the one with the money and right. yada, yada, yada. But what I think that does is then robs kids of their agency, and they're taught that they don't have agency over what they get to read, what they get to consume, what thoughts they get to think. And I've heard this in relation with discussion of X-Men 97 and how this reboot deals with some very adult territory. But the reason why the writers and producers and cast felt that they could, you know, get away with that. You know, they deal with a genocide. They deal with othering, racism. They deal with bigotry in all sorts of forms and fashions. And the reason they felt that they could tell those stories just like they did in those original episodes in the early 90s and just like they do in the comics and have for decades is because kids are people too.
Yeah.
And comics, stories, fantasy is, you know, they're seeing these things, they're living these lives, they're aware of the world around them.
Yeah.
And they need a place to process that.
Yeah.
And if we never give them stories to, you know, kind of process those things, to see other kids their age going through those things and how they got through it, they never learn hope. They never learn, you know, that there is another side, and they never learn that sometimes there isn't another side, but there's still a life that can be made where you are. And I think that robbing of that agency is doing them a disservice, and it's just further keeping them from growing.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're probably in complete lockstep agreement that children should have access to a wide array of diverse stories that are exactly germane to their life and outside, completely outside of their lived experience. And that all of those things are invaluable for them being able to safely explore their own identity and their own understanding of the world and their own philosophies about what's right and wrong for themselves. And I think, you know, I think we're talking about like slightly separate things with like the buying power, because there's the gatekeeping aspect. And I think that's when we tend to get really precious. And that's when grownups with really good intentions are fucking annoying. And then there's also the buying power of like, these are just readers who enjoy this kind of story. So they're moving the market in a certain direction.
100%.
And I think the gatekeeping aspect is the one I am the most familiar with how to talk about, because I was a bookseller for such a long time. I have had that conversation ad nauseum with parents, with teachers, with librarians about like, well, what is and what isn't appropriate to present to kids. And I do think that booksellers tend to be pretty forward thinking in that for a lot of reasons. But in terms of like the buying power of the market, I don't know that there is an easy solution, because we exist in capitalism, and it's not like, I don't want to look at adult readers and be like, get the fuck out of here. Like that's not it either. Like, they should get to enjoy these stories. It's a difficult thing. I do think, and here's where I start sounding, I think, like a little crazy, that before I say everything I'm about to say, I want to clarify that I love young adult. It's my favorite genre. And I think about it all the time with great affection and respect and love. I also think that adults have forgotten how to engage with adult media, that we have forgotten how to take in stories that are not coming of age stories. And I think that sense of like heroism and this sense of individuality and of like one climactic cathartic moment that is life defining is very young adult and is very adolescent and deserves to exist and is so important. And those are like essential stories for understanding the world. And also, adults should be able to take in stories that have unsatisfying endings and that have difficult climaxes and that
unlikable
have
protagonists.
Well, I think teens should take that too. But
I am in full agreement with you. Adults coming in and saying, I just didn't like the protagonist.
Yeah, you're fuck not you. I don't like you. So, and I still have to live
That's
in a world with you.
Protagonist doesn't mean good guy, and good guy can make bad decisions too, even if they are a good guy.
Like all of that stuff. But also like things like continued care is like not a young adult hallmark. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of sustainability and like how we build community over a very long period of time. Mm. These are not ideas that are necessarily exactly conducive to the young adult genre, but are also exactly the things that we struggle with in American society. Of like, we are very reactive to sort of like moments of anger or sadness or great joy or whatever. And we like that. We like that feeling of like, we chase those sort of like extreme emotional experiences, but we really struggle with just the difficulty of sustained care for other people, for our communities, for everything, right? Like we don't do that. And we keep watching these stupid fucking, excuse me, I'll start
It's
again.
Okay. Adults listen to my show. It's fine.
All these. Oh, no, it wasn't the cussing. I was worried about what I was just about to say. We keep kind of watching all these like Star Wars, Marvel, Disney products that sell this story of individual heroism. And I think we are past the point where the notion of individual heroism is helpful for Western society. I think we have explored that idea to its greatest extent. And we have really struggled with any kind of understanding of collectivism. And in part, that is due to, I think, the most successful story format for capitalism is inherently an adolescent one, is one that like does that kind of exciting, cathartic work of coming of age, which is so important. But adults should be past that to some extent. I think we should be able to enjoy young adult literature and take things from it and feel changed by it. It's in no way like a grow up message that I'm trying to give here at all. I do think, though, that we are struggling to understand stories that are not that, like as a collective.
Well, the book discourse on social media is the bane, I think, of every author's experience these days.
Yeah.
But I think the pushback, not my pushback, but the pushback that I have seen from other adults that consume mm-hmm. that and say that they should be, that they want to consume that and consume that almost exclusively is because, you know, the world is big and scary and sad and reading is an escape for them.
Totally.
And so they want their escape to be simple and safe, and they know the ending, and, you know, the hero gets the girl or gets the guy or gets the, you know, whatever. And mm-hmm. You know, good triumphs over evil, and it's all in neat and tidy, and it's totally. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But I
both things can be true. Like
both things can be true. However, I think that the problem with that is, I think kind of what you're saying, that story can only be told so many times in so many different ways until an adult then gets online and like starts complaining about like, well, I've seen this, you know, 50 different ways. Yes, but that kid that this book is written for might not have.
Sure. That is also true. I just think like both of those, all of these things are true at the same time. And I have mm-hmm. a great sympathy for people who are like, listen, I'm not here to like stare into the void of the ugliness of human existence. I'm here for a good time. I would like smooches. I would like a happy ending. Like, great. I love this for you. I love it for me. I read a ton of romance, and I think it is like great for my mental health to just like, there are times where like, I just can't do a heavy nonfiction book right now.
Yep.
I'm going to read a Sarah McLean novel because it's going to do the trick and I'm going to feel great. And there's going to be sexy banter and they're going to fuck and I'm going to have a great time. This is not meant to be a judgment on any individual readers' habits. And in fact, I think the people who tend to participate in discourse are not the people who I am concerned about. Mm. It is, I think, largely people who take in sort of like the monoculture without any sort of question that I am most sort of like, oh, I see. I think like, and that's most people. Like book Twitter, book talk is such a like tiny segment of humanity.
It is. And yeah, I wish people and knew like that.
We will argue with each other forever, and that's fine. And I largely just don't participate because I feel like it's irrelevant to me.
It's the same five fights.
So like that's fine. And every generation of readers needs to have those five fights, and that's great. And I went through a period of time where I loved having those fights. And now I'm old and it's for young people to have those fights. But I'm talking about sort of like the monoculture of the United States, because there really is only about like four places that, you know, we're getting most of our media from, you know, like, and so I am talking more about that than I am about anyone who's participating in any kind of discourse, because by the time you get to the discourse, you have already self-selected for people who really question and think about the kind of media that they take in, which is unusual and not the way that most people interact with their movies and books and TV.
You know, I could spend forever kind of in that space, but I do, I do want to talk about something else that's happened for you, to you, with you, about you, in the last year. I can't believe it was only a year ago, I think.
Is this the Scholastic thing?
Yes. This is the Scholastic thing. Yeah. Yeah. I know I'm not Jake Tapper, but I am going to ask you about it. I guess first,
my boyfriend, Jake
Tapper. First of all, what's Jake Tapper like?
I mean, in the 25 seconds that I interacted with, not him exactly, just his disembodied voice.
I was in my living room watching you live, like recording you with my phone, like a little proud.
Bless
like,
you. That will be my only CNN appearance. So I'm glad that somebody cared.
Go back.
Yeah. When you go on that show, I thought I would be like FaceTiming with him basically, but you don't. You FaceTime with the CNN logo, so you can't see his facial expressions or like anything like that. So you're just talking to a blank
wall. You didn't
see
him the whole time?
No. And so in commercial, right before we went into my segment, he was really kind and he made me feel really comfortable and like welcome to be there, you know, and I was like, okay, well, I'm in love with you forever now. I hear you're also very tall. It's done. I love you now. I wish he didn't have such bad opinions about foreign policy because it makes it very hard to stay in love with him. But but he was very kind to me personally, and I appreciated it.
So the reason that you were on CNN is because your children's book that we talked about a few minutes ago, Love in the Library, was selected by Scholastic for inclusion in their much coveted book fair.
Well, it wasn't actually a book fair thing. It was Education Solutions, which includes the book fair division. It was for a like featured display that would go out to educators. So Scholastic has relationships with something like 90% of schools in the United States. That's like a direct relationship, which makes them really unusual for publishers. They're the only ones who do this. I don't understand antitrust laws, but it feels, anyway, it's fine. And so my book was selected by a group of Asian American and Pacific Islander educators and authors who thought that Love in the Library, which is about Japanese American incarceration and how my maternal grandparents met in a Japanese American incarceration camp during World War II, is like an essential part of understanding the Asian American experience. And they had gotten a lot of pushback from Scholastic at the onset. They didn't present them Love in the Library as one of the options of books that they could consider. And somebody on the panel kind of demanded that it be brought forward. And then once they did choose it, they were discouraged from choosing it, but they chose it anyway. And then unbeknownst to that panel of authors and educators, Scholastic went behind their backs and went to me and said, we would love to make you this offer, but in order to be included in this, in your author's note, you have to remove an entire paragraph that kind of links what happened to your grandparents to the larger history of racism in the United States. But not only that, you have to remove the word racism from the author's note altogether. And I don't know about you, but I feel like it's fucking impossible to talk about Japanese American incarceration without using the word racism. And so I had gone back originally and was like, is my deal contingent on this? Like, can I just reject this? And they were like, no, like, yeah, it's contingent on this. You have to delete this. And so I went public with my response to them, which was, I think, a very polite double middle fingers to the sky of like, no, and here's why this is such an offensive offer. But I, at the time when I went public, I didn't know about the entire background of these authors and educators having pushed for this book and selected it. And so it was this kind of double betrayal of like, the deal came to me and it was such a fucked up deal, right? But it was also fucked up to these authors and educators who had put their names on this project, lovingly selected this book, advocated for it, and had no idea that this was happening. And so it was like a complicated and ugly situation. And I have become close with a couple of the people that were on it since then because of this. And it's like, haha, hilarious that we're friends now because of racism. But, you know, like what we are. There was like a big backlash against them, kind of predictably, hence me being on CNN. And then they came back. And their first apology was like, it's not in our company policy to do this. And I was like, hilarious, because it happened. And their second apology was like a little bit more realistic. And they were like, would you have a meeting with us? And I was like, absolutely. Because I did genuinely want to fix it. Like, I just wanted to work.
Especially because you're in the room, and what happens in that room while you're in there might have positive ramifications for future people who could get in that room.
Right. Like, I felt like from my purposes, I accepted their more realistic apology. It's like, that's kind of all you need to do for me is like, you apologized. I can't demand that much more for myself. However, I can demand a lot more for my community. And I went into that meeting with three goals, which was an honest recounting of how this had happened, because I had been given nothing but bullshit. And, you know, like, if they're doing this to me, they're doing this to other people. And true enough, my DMs like lit up with people's stories, not just from Scholastic, but from all of the major publishers. And it's not Scholastic's job to fix everybody, but it is their job to fix themselves. I asked them how they were going to make sure that this never happened to another author like me ever again. That was really important to me, because what is an apology to me if they're just going to keep perpetuating the same behavior? Meaningless, right? And then third, I wanted to know what they were doing to combat book bans, because that's ultimately what this was about, was they wanted to be able to sell this book to the same kinds of people who would ban my story anyway. And I am not interested in capitulating or rounding down the sharp edges of my grandparents' story to appease those people. That's not the fucking point. And that was really the most important aspect to me, and the part that I was really excited to hear what they were doing, because they are a billion-dollar corporation. They have means, and they have an incredible framework within the educational community to make differences, right? But they weren't able to kind of do any of that. They gave me a very, what I considered, dishonest answer about what had happened. When I asked them what they were going to do to make sure this never happened again, they gave an answer that sounded good on its face, which is, we are going to hire people from outside of Scholastic to come into Scholastic to tell us what went wrong so that it never happens again. But for old people like me, we remember in 2014 when they made the same kind of offer to Lauren Miracle for the book Love Ya Bunches, but for their book fair division, which is an even bigger amount of money. That's that's the golden calf of the Scholastic universe, right? And Lauren said no, and she said no publicly. And they were like, the deal was, we'll take your book for book fairs, but you have to take the gay dads out of the book, which is like so ugly. And Lauren said no, and she said no publicly. And there was a huge backlash, and Scholastic said, oh my God, we're so, 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 so sorry. We're going to hire people from outside of Scholastic to come into Scholastic to tell us what went wrong so that it never happens again. So what the fuck are you going to learn in 2020 or in 2023 that you didn't learn in 2014? Like, get the fuck out of here. And then lastly, what are you doing for book bans? And the answer was basically bupkis. Nothing. Nothing meaningful.
I do.
And so
I want to stress for people who are not authors themselves, it cannot have been easy to be staring down the barrel of hey, this could be a great foot in the door to get in, you know, to get my kids' books, to get my YA books, to get my books into those book fairs. That's a that's visibility, that's money, that's serious money in the you know, young.
It's longevity. It's the kind of thing that keeps it's your a book career. In print. It's not gonna make you a billionaire, but it is like that's the difference of your book staying in print or going out of print.
It can be in those, especially those younger age group spaces, because like what we were talking about earlier, that's where my head went with agency is, you know, okay, well, I've got my $10. I'm going to go to the book fair. I can pick whatever I want at the book fair because there's no adult holding my hand telling me no, I can buy whatever I want. And that's
an essential space.
That's how those kids can find themselves in stories, can see themselves, can buy those books and all of that kind of thing. So that, I mean, that can't have been an easy no.
No. Well, yes and no. Like, I made the decision pretty quickly. Like, and I was ready to like burn down their offices before I asked for clarification. And bless my husband, who was like, can you at least ask and like double check that they are saying that that's what the deal is before you... You like light yourself on
fire. So then
when
they said yes, did he have to pull the gas can out of your hand? Were you?
No, he was like, he was on my side. He was just like, just be sure. Like,
if you're going to commit arson, make sure it's worth it.
Yeah. Like, which I think is a very reasonable person to have in your life. The person who's like, I'm with you. I'm behind you. Just be sure. Just double check before you do anything rash. And like, because I read the email. And I was like in the world, just like pushing my daughter in a stroller. And I was on a walk and I like checked my email because I have a personality disorder. And I saw like offer from Scholastic and I was like, oh! Like I like made like a big noise.
As you would.
Like, oh my God, because the book had been out for a year. Like I thought that the window had passed when they would ever, you know, like license it. So like, that's incredible. I'm so excited. And I went, what the fuck, out loud in public also, because it just, it was so egregious and it was so on the nose for like, there was no like pussyfooting around what they were asking. They're like, given like the difficult political climate we're in right now, like we just can't, like the offer is contingent on this thing. And it was like, oh my God. And so it was easy because I knew it was the right decision. And I knew it was the right decision because this isn't like a story I made up. I think, I don't know that I would have been quite as forthright in my response for any of my fiction because it is not, there's always an element of invention where it's like, well, but you like, okay, you might be talking about real things, but you made this shit up. So like, you know, I don't know. There's like, I feel a little bit more like I can hear an argument more calmly about some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And with this one, I was like, no, like, get the fuck out of here. Like, this is not just my grandparents' story. Their story is so normal for Japanese Americans who are incarcerated that I hear all the time from families whose grandparents met the same way or who, you know, from somebody who was born in one of these camps or whatever it was. And to sell them out that way, it was not a hard choice to say no. What was hard was deciding to go public, which I also decided pretty quickly. I don't know that it speaks well of my character, but I was immediately just like so angry and so sure that I was not the only person who was getting these kinds of offers. Because it was just so clear how comfortable they felt making that offer. They gave me a PDF with the red line through everything that they were going to take out of my author's note. It was, the receipts were astounding. And it was just like, that is the behavior of somebody who is accustomed to getting their way. And that also made me really resentful.
And if this
resentful.
Has gone to you, you are not the first author that, you're not the first author that has gotten that red line. You're not the first author, you know, and the thing is, there's probably a bunch of authors that have gotten those red lines and said, I need to eat. And Scholastic is a, you know,
totally
a big meal. And but somebody in your position saying no makes it easier for other people to say no.
Before I'm canonized about this, let's be real clear. Like, I was able to make this decision because I come from a ton of privilege. Like, I have the privilege of generational wealth. I have the privilege of having accidentally fallen in love with somebody whose skill set is far more paid than my own. And so there was a moment where Adam and I were talking and I was like, if this actually does tank my whole career, it's not going to affect our bottom line as a family, hardly at all.
But that's why I said, I didn't want to go there if you didn't want to go there.
No, it's okay.
But
I think it's worth being frank about. But the thing is,
that's why I'm saying, you being able to say no means that somebody else who doesn't have those same privileges at least has the solidarity of being able to say, okay, she can say no, I can also say no.
Yeah. I mean, I had a conversation with another author whose name I'm obviously not going to say, who was
Was it Stephen King?
Girl, could you imagine?
She tosses her hair.
No, this younger, black author who is a scholastic author. And in the period of time that followed this, a mere 5 months later, they were embroiled in a new controversy because they tried to sell segregated book fairs to all of their
girl, people. I remember that.
It was wild. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was so
They thought that was going to be, I think, the answer to kind of the wild thing with you was that, we're going to allow schools to opt out. We're going to make this something that you can opt in or out
book
of.
Collection.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was talking to this other author and she was like, I feel like I should say something, like you said something, and I feel like I should. And I was like, I want to stop you right there. The reason why I think what I did was well received is, again, due to privileges that I have not earned. It is not because of my good word. It's not because I was so trusted and respected in the industry. The reason why there was so much positive response for me is because I am not Black and I am cis. If this had happened to a Black person or a transgender person, the response would have been really different. And I got called in to be a voice on this issue in a way that I didn't earn, that I don't deserve, and that frankly, I am not the best person to be the ambassador for because I am not of the identities that are largely targeted in these sort of book bannings and censorious responses. If I had been Palestinian, can you fucking imagine? Nobody would have said anything. But I was on Jake Tapper's show because I come in a friendly cisgender, person of color, but white adjacent look that makes white people comfortable.
But I,
for better and absolutely for worse.
I mean, I don't come from generational wealth, but I do, I have the cis white thing going on and it has allowed me to
totally
be in rooms and to be, be the safe homosexual to invite into the diversity group or the diversity room or something like that.
Right.
And I think what you did is something that I always try to do as well, is not be the last person in that room. At least use those privileges to hold that door open and to make sure that other people in that room who were there before you were know why you're holding that door open so that it doesn't take as long for somebody else and somebody better to be that voice. Yeah.
That is 100% true. I will say one of the most painful things I learned from the Scholastic thing is that sometimes it's not worth going through the door at all. And I learned that most pointedly, I got interviewed by the New York Times about it. And they were like, can you help us find other authors who have received these kinds of offers from different publishers? And I was like, absolutely, I can. Because my DMs had just blown up with this shit. And three of the people I reached out to who had reached out to me to express solidarity, upset, whatever, and their own story, were like, well, I'm not going to talk to the New York Times because they always misconstrue our stories. One of them has that's too personal a detail. Anyway, a couple of them had personal interactions with it that were really negative, that had never seen any kind of recourse. And they were like, so no, I'm not willing to talk to them. And I was like, ugh, okay, but here's our chance. We can tell the truth. We can do this. But they were saying no. And I was like, okay, well, I respect it. And then the story came out and it was a fine story, but it was not at all what had been sold to me it was going to be. And it was not at all about sort of the larger issue at hand. It was very much about me and my personal decision and this particular thing. And it was like, this is not, and it's not that I felt like betrayed, but I was like, oh, right. That dorm was not worth going through for these people. And in retrospect, I wonder if it was worth going through for me.
That always,
because that was when that article came out, is when I did start receiving messages like, I wish your children were dead, mm-hmm. like that kind of stuff. And it's like, mm-hmm. wow, okay. All right. And so like, I even went back to all those authors who'd said no and been like, you were right. And one of them hasn't talked to me since. And I think she was kind of like, this dizzy bitch, like, how do you not, like, how do you not understand what the larger structure you're purportedly protesting, but still partaking in is like? And I think she was right. And I think it has really, for me, made me really dubious. My initial thing is always just like, come in after me. Like, the door is open. I'm always here to help other people, like, in ways that other people didn't necessarily help me. But what I have been trying to do since then is to be really frank with everyone who I am holding the door open for, to be like, are you sure you want to come in? Because this is what it's like. I'll help you. But this door, on the other end, lies some shitty behavior that's going to make you feel bad about yourself. It's going to make you feel alone in the world. And it's going to make you feel like essential parts of your lived experience are not respected or valued or in any way, like, relevant to your own work.
And those kinds of stories very often do not ask the right questions because the answers are inconvenient to the wider totally. Audience who would consume it. It always reminds me of those like local news stories. I don't see them as much on national news. They're always on like the local news at the very end of that 10 o'clock broadcast where it's like, mm-hmm. look at this Black guy who just got this used Honda for free because he had to walk 10 miles every day to get to his job. And his boss loved him so much, he gave him a used Honda after yada, yada, yada.
One act of kindness as opposed to the structural inequity that caused that
Why
situation.
Are we having, right. like, it's so many other questions you could be asking there.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. inequity, I mean, public transportation and pay disparity and all of the education problems and all sorts yeah. of things that you could be asking, but instead it's, well, wasn't this one nice thing nice?
I mean, I think that's back to what we were talking about our sort of monoculture being unable to handle more complicated stories. It means not asking those questions. It means having the one cathartic emotional moment and then moving on and feeling like that's done and dusted.
So let's talk about the monoculture, because the monoculture has become very afraid of books in recent years. We've seen a year-over-year increase for the last several years in book mm-hmm. bans, which I yes. think to me personally, I always associated book bans and book burning with like mm-hmm. sepia-toned Nazis. Yesteryear, like something that happened in history books. Oh, those crazy, unevolved people in that bygone era that existed in the long, long ago.
Yeah.
It's back. It's more pernicious than ever. It's sold under the guise. It's very often targeted like towards queer authors, queer voices. It is also, of course, targeted to authors of color as well and stories of color. But from your perspective, intersecting in all of those worlds, why are people mm-hmm. so afraid of books these days?
I don't think they actually are afraid of books. I don't think it has anything to do with books fucking at all. I think, frankly, I think the people who are incredibly effective at organizing people around this mm. have found the most expeditious way to defund institutions of public learning. Mm. And that is their ultimate goal. And the fact that it creates a framework for physical violence against historically marginalized people is just a cool bonus, because they don't give a fuck about those people either. And I think that they have realized that people's easily inflamed bigotries are the easiest way to deputize idiots into doing their bidding. And I don't think it has anything to do with the books, because most of the time they've never read the books. And I think most of the time it has nothing to do with the books. It has everything to do with the people who made them. And it's a way of reminding those of us who have been historically marginalized that our privilege of having a voice can be taken away at any moment is an essential part of why this is happening. I think you see the backlash against, you know, everything from the Obama administration to just people of color and queer people being successful. This has to do with that resentment of like, I can't handle that. So this is a way that I can exercise that anger of like, I was told that if I was obedient and I was white, then I would get everything that I wanted and I didn't. And this is a way to deal with that anger. And yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with the books at all. And but that doesn't mean the people who make books get to be indifferent.
You go into schools because mm-hmm. you've obviously, you've been writing YA for a while. You've been writing children's books now for a while. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you write those kinds of books, you get invited into those kinds of spaces.
Yeah.
What do the readers, the kids who are actually reading these books, what are they seeing in books featuring diverse stories, characters that look like them, authors that look like them? What do kids say about these stories?
All the things you'd expect. You know, like sometimes they're just confused. Why did this happen? Why do adults do bad things? And you have to tell them the truth. And sometimes my school visits are really upsetting and I come home and I cry because kids will ask like really pointed questions where they're just like, why did they do this to Japanese American people? Why did they do this to Black people? Like, why, what's going on? And you have to just tell them the truth that there's such a thing called racism and it's really, you know, pernicious and terrible and, you know, it's not fair, but all of us have the choice to fight against it if we want to. And that I encourage them to, and that they all have power in this situation. They, you know, whenever I go to majority, like schools where the majority of kids are kids of color, I get a lot of questions just about me. Like they're just curious how I got there. And I think it's the first time they're realizing that someone who looks like them could do something like that. And that's really wonderful. And I always, feel nervous in those situations because I don't think I'm a good role model, nor am I particularly interested in being one. But like, you know, I see the value there. But I also think a lot about, you know, activism you hear out of the Black community where you hear like Black faces in high spaces does not mean liberation. Mm-hmm. And like, I just am always really cognizant of that. And not that I'm in like such a high place, but like I'm in enough of a vaunted position that it already makes me nervous of like, just because I'm here does not mean that things are demonstrably better or will be fair to you.
Well, because then, you know, if you're in the room and you're there, mm-hmm. sometimes what happens is that company, that publisher, that whatever checks you off. They check the box.
Exactly.
You're the box they checked. Oh, we did it. We're done.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know for a fact, especially at some of the private schools that I go to visit, that they're like, and here we have our Asian speaker for Asian History Month. Take it away, Maggie. And you're like, oh my God, let death come for me.
I've never talked about this on this publicly, but at a former job, so I don't work there anymore and haven't in many years, so it's fine now. In the wake of George Floyd, when every company everywhere was like, no, we're diverse. We're so diverse. Look
they
at-
They didn't hold you up, did they? Your beautiful little blonde head.
The company was trying to push, like put a, you know, it's like they were doing the thing where they were just trying to like force all the Black people in the room to tell everybody at the company that racism was bad. You know, we got to have our team huddles. We had to have a weekly team meeting. We didn't really have any Black people on our team. I was the most diverse person. So they asked me to lead a meeting as to why like diversity is good and bigotry in the workplace is bad. And I kept saying, I should not be doing this. I don't think it's remotely appropriate that I should be doing this. I'll do it if you make me.
That is like an onion joke. Like the, like, I think
I did eventually, like,
but
I did have a coworker. She was Black and she came with me. Like, we were on different teams at the time, and she came in and, like, talked with me, but she also didn't, you know, I do the public speaking thing, you know, like that I have this skill set and she does not. She's a very quiet person who does not want to be up in front of people. And so like it was
the
just
ambassador for all Black people.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want that job.
Nope,
that's
she
so
did not
weird.
Want to do that.
That's
funny
so
enough.
Weird that she didn't want that job.
I know. And they were like, hey, we need to have a meeting and we want to listen to you talk about how hard it is in the workplace. I was like, this is bad. This is bad. What is happening? This is bad. This is the bad thing.
Yeah. We're in the bad place. Yeah. That's hilarious. Not like haha hilarious, just hilarious.
it's like, yeah, corporate. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I used to work for Apple. And so I feel like I don't even need to say anymore. I just feel like everyone can kind of infer what I mean.
You get it. It was also equally one of those very, very, very big companies. And it was just like I that same year, I don't know, it was the same year, year after, maybe year before, I had gotten into a leadership position with the LGBT group that did, mm-hmm. you know, pride stuff for the company. And I'd made it into a leadership position and they said, oh, we're doing this year's pride. They were trying to do that thing that everybody's doing this year because everybody's scared of conservatives this year. We're gonna celebrate allies. And so the big event this year is going to be the vice president of the company is going to fly in from New York to the offices here in Chicago. And he is going to talk about what it means to be an ally in the workplace. And I remember being in that meeting and I said, cool. Great. Love this for us. Except what if we didn't do that? And what if instead we had a panel of people who actually work for the company get up on stage who were queer themselves and told all those rich white people in the audience who run everything what it's actually like to work for their company as a marginalized person? And what if that panel was mostly made up of queer people of color? And could we please have the moderator be a trans person, please? Could we just maybe not do any of what you said and do this whole other thing? And so we ended up doing that whole other thing and it was the best attended pride event they'd ever had. But I was like, do you see how it's different? Do you see how it's different? Instead of you telling us what it's like to work for you, how about we tell you what it's like to work for you and what we need?
We did it. There was a Women at iTunes event.
Was it led by a man?
Yes. Yes, it was. Two male managers got up and spoke and then asked us for recommendations for any women they thought we should hire. And I knew I was quitting at that point, but like I couldn't tell anyone at work. And I was on a very like cool feminist team and we were all just like walking back to our office like, what the fuck was that? And they were so mad. And I remember just being like, I'm free. Like, this isn't my problem. This isn't for me to fix. This is above my pay grade. Like, nope, no, thank you. Go fix your fucking women problems. Anyway.
You helped found Authors Against Book mm-hmm. Bans.
Yes.
I do want to make sure that sure we did. Talk about that because I yes. am a member and I love it.
Yeah.
I love it so very, very much. I got to be in a meeting with Judy Blume's face. I got to be in a room where somebody who was operating Judy Blume's computer logged on mm-hmm. and I got to see the word Judy Blume. So I get to tell people I was in a meeting with Judy Blume.
Yes.
So tell me about Authors Against Book Bans.
Yeah. So we are a group of volunteers. We are nationally organized, but locally or like grassroots level set up to basically respond to book bans as they come up within the community. And what our real goal is to basically be the author army that gets deployed by the grassroots organizations that are doing this work all of the time. Because it's not as though there were not incredible advocacy groups already on the ground. But authors were not very organized around this. And I feel like within our community, we were kind of looking around and being like, okay, who's going to do it? Who's going to do it, guys? Who's going to organize us? And it was like, oh, shit, it has to be us, huh? All right. So, of course, it was a bunch of kids' book authors that started this. And, you know, like, we're not delusional. It's not that we think that authors are going to be the ones that fix this for everybody. but we do think that we're an essential part of this fight, and we want to, you know, be organized and be able to respond in a timely and organized fashion. And so right now we have about 1,500 members, which is great. And I'm very proud of the growth that we have had. But for perspective, the Penguin Random House author email list is 16,000 people long. So we
That's have, a lot.
Yeah. I think until we can say we're the same size as that email list, we are going to have limited power in terms of doing things like negotiating with publishers. Right now, we represent a small few of us. But we would like to do things like push publishers to be more active in this fight and to be more proactive and not just reactive, because they're the ones who have resources. And we want to do things like create, you know, banned bookmobiles that go to the places that are banning books. We want to be able to send authors into meetings, but we want to provide training for everybody who does and things like that. We have created a ton of resources with all of the expertise that we already have in-house, because so many of us are authors who have been banned so much. But one of our other goals is to recruit authors who haven't been banned and who feel horrified by what's going on and feel like there's nothing they could do and it's not their place to speak because they're not the ones being banned. Not true anymore. You have a place to be. We would like you to be here. We would like to deputize everybody to feel comfortable talking about this so that everyone can finish their school assembly with two slides about the rise of book bans and what everyone can do to fight them. Or to do things like, you know, at all of their public facing events, be, you know, mentioning that this is something that matters to them and, you know, things like that. And also doing things like just signing on to open letters, because often that is what happens. We are also doing things like making videos and letters for people who are fighting this fight in places where people outside of the community are not welcome to come in. So we've done things like make rallying videos for people before they go and speak to their school board or to their state legislature or whatever, to get them like amped up to speak on it. We've written letters of concern and solidarity and support to librarians who are fighting, or to ones like the ones in Prattville, Alabama, who all were fired for refusing to take LGBTQ books off the shelves. There's so much that needs to be done at every given moment with this group. And one thing that is important to know about us is that we're a single issue group. This is it. We are what it says on the tin. We are authors and illustrators and audiobook narrators and anthology contributors and editors and you know, anyone who's translators, anyone who's had their name on a book, against book bans. What that allows us to do is to focus exactly on that fight. Sometimes, because that's the thing.
It's a big one.
Every time all these adjacent issues keep coming up and we'll be like, should we get involved? And we're like, we can't, because we don't have the bandwidth, because just when we focus on book bans, we are already stretched too thin. We are already losing this fight in such a significant way. And you can look, you know, like if you live in Idaho, there's that new bill there.
I just found out about that this weekend. And right after this, I'm going to go finish that research and do a freaking video about that, because that's where we're really now having noxious. Adults only libraries.
Yes. Donnelly's public library in Idaho has become adult only starting on July 1st in reaction to this new state law that basically makes it possible for anyone to go into any library, pick a book off the shelf and go, I find this offensive. And then the library has to
pay
like
them $250.
Yes.
And so then a physically lock the book up.
Yes. It's insane. And so it's just an invitation for book banners to come into every library and to defund them, basically.
That's
libraries like Donnelly are like, the only way to deal with this is to become adults only, which is bananas.
And people, so I don't think, realized how small the operating budget is for some libraries, especially more rural libraries. It can be just a few thousand dollars a year.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's terrifying. Libraries are not the fat cats of society.
No.
So putting anything where they foot the bill for people's opinions is wild. It's truly wild. And so, I mean, like even in Illinois, which has passed anti-book banning legislation, which seems like a good idea, but there's still sort of a book bounty element to it, where if people find stuff, there's, I think, like a $200 fee that they can be given if it turns out to be correct. But then, you know, there's that like sway of the library then has to divert manpower and therefore money into dealing with this problem. And then, you know, whatever, it's just a way of creating expense. And I just, to be very, very clear, the long game of book bans is not about keeping kids safe. That's a straw man argument. The people who are making it don't care about that. That's not what's happening. There's no pornography in the children's book section to begin with. Mm-mm. There are too many guardrails in place, too many professionals involved. That's an insane thing to say. There's no porn there. That's a straw man. It is about defunding public institutions of learning. And you made a really great video about the Huntington Beach situation. And one of the things to keep in mind about that is that book banning city ordinance is largely to set the framework for privatizing the library entirely, destroying the public amenity and making it something that a private group of individuals are paid for creating and like maintaining.
Well, what I found so interesting about the feedback to that was how many people immediately write it off, which is something that we, especially liberal, snooty folks that mm-hmm. get to live in big cities or suburbs or something and get to feel very safe and secure in our areas and say, well, Huntington Beach was already conservative. Like, it's conservative. What do you want to do? And what I don't think a lot of people realize is when they write off an area as conservative – like I always, I grew up in Texas and yeah, it's conservative and it votes very red, but it votes very red because it's been gerrymandered to hell and back. And yeah. It disenfranchises the voice of 40-something% of the population. If they were ever allowed to vote, you know, just up or down, it would be a whole lot more purple. And it pretends like queer people, people of color, you know, are not living in those areas. But also, yeah. I didn't realize because of that story how many libraries were already moving to some level of privatization.
Yeah.
I had no idea that they were hiring management companies to come in
and
basically privatize the library.
It's not good out there, Don.
No.
It's bad.
It's bad. But you know what I love about being a member of AABB is the resources mm-hmm. that you guys have been putting together, and
yes.
something that gives me a lot of hope is that kids do respond. They read so much more when they can read stories about people like them by authors who look like them, like so much more. Though it's crazy.
Yeah.
I love learning things like that, and I wouldn't have learned that had it not been for being a member of AABB.
Yeah, I mean, we can provide you with talking points. We can provide you for templates for creating voter guides around the issue of book banning for your school board or city council. They're already made. They're for free. You can have them, and we have a videotaped guide on how to use them, led by Frank Strong, who's an activist out of Texas who does incredible work and has flipped a lot of school boards. And I think school boards are a really fruitful place to focus because so few votes can make the difference in them. And they have the most direct impact on a community out of any of these places where our votes count and matter. And so those down ballot votes matter so, so much. And we've created guides for those things. We have like training on how to give school presentations about this, how to write an op-ed about this, how to testify in front of a school board or in front of a city council about this in under 2 minutes. We have all kinds of things, and we're just working on making more. And so if you are a person with expertise in this, we want you. If you're a person who has never talked about book bans before in your life, but have sort of an instinctual, disgusted reaction to it because you understand that it is a fundamental violation of human rights, then like, come on in. The tent is big. We would like you. We don't care if you've been traditionally or independently published. I don't care if you have one short story published in one anthology that only sold 200 copies. You're an author, and we would like you. And also, if you're Stephen King, you can come too, okay?
Hey, listen, I feel like you got Judy Blume. Like, that's just, like, all of these big authors, like, come on.
We have some really fancy names in there. And if you want to randomly be in a meeting with Lois Lowry, which is the thing that happened to me, by all means, please join us. We email you like once every 3 weeks at the max. Like, we're very low touch. It's a volunteer organization. We're not here to yell at you. Like, we're not going to text you ever. So like, it's an easy group of people to join to do work. And even if you just sign up and never do anything with us again, your membership is incredibly valuable so that we can go to people like HarperCollins and say, we represent 1,500, but ideally an order of magnitude more than that, authors. And here's what we think you should be doing around book bans. And the more of us there are, the more powerful that message is. Right now, we are too small to affect the kind of change that I believe we should be capable of in this regard. And so even if you're signing up just to give a middle finger to some publishers who haven't done enough, your membership is valuable. Even if you sign up just to receive our emails every once in a while and maybe once out of every 14 of them forward them along to somebody, your membership is valuable. And even if you just sign up to receive information so that when you're at dinner parties and cocktail parties, you can speak to this with like a slightly more expertise grounded situation, like that's worth it too, because there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about book bans. And one of the number one things I would like to be really clear about is that we're losing. We're losing this fight. We are way behind in terms of organization. But the good news is when we are present, we tend to win because they are counting on scaring people out of defending themselves. One of the most effective tactics is referring to educators and librarians as groomers and saying that the only reason that they want to give kids these kinds of media is because they're pedophiles and they want to sexually assault them. And that is such a horrifying thing to be accused of. I absolutely understand every single educator who's like, nope, it's okay, never mind, I won't put it there. Because that is a huge risk that they are personally incurring for our work as authors. And they shouldn't have to. And they shouldn't have to do that alone.
One of the other things that I've really enjoyed learning more about, I mean, I knew this before joining, but I've loved learning more about the nuances of it, is how AABB has helped to provide more weight to the conversation. Because I think that there's a lot of authors out there that might maybe have a bit more lackadaisical view of book bans because they think, well, if my book gets banned, then I'm just going to go buy a second home, you know, with all of my money that I'm going to make because my book was banned. So obviously I'm rich now. And I appreciate
all of my books, except for Also an Octopus, have been banned and nobody's sending me checks about it. I just want to be really clear.
Well, and what I've loved is, one, getting to be in the meetings, hearing from authors whose books were banned, seeing the resources be put together so that authors know, like, no, that the books that benefit from that sales bump, because there's a documented sales bump. Sure. Yeah.
Huge national media moments, which most of us don't get.
Huge national media moments. And those books were largely already bestsellers. They were already known in some regard. They were books that either already had movies made about them or, you know, TV shows that were adapted. They had been on some lists already. They had some kind of renown. So when, such and such book gets banned, not that book. I loved that movie. What?
Yeah. I know it's like crass to talk about your own personal sales numbers, but I feel like it's worth it in this case. So when the Love in the Library controversy happened, everyone was like, is it just like selling through the roof? Like, is this just crazy? And there was a sales bump.
Yeah.
No, for like 2 or 3 months, there was like a pretty sustained, like higher level of sales than Love in the Library had seen that was interrupted in part because my publisher had no idea this moment was coming. Mm-hmm. And so there weren't enough books to meet the need.
You're with Candlewick, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they're so great. They're also a smaller publisher.
Not one of the big, huge ones.
No. Yeah. So they did everything they could to rush it as fast as they could, and they did, and like, good for them. They're great. But even at the height of like, this is crazy, those sales numbers were lower than the entire first months of Squad sales numbers. One of my young adult graphic novels. That was like listen, that book rips and I'm very proud of it and everyone should read it and buy it. But like those bumps, it was big for Love in the Library, but it wasn't like, whoa, now I'm going to go buy a castle in Scotland. Like it was like, oh, now I'm going to get coffee out twice this week. Like that's what kind of money it is.
Yeah.
And so like, this is not in any way to be ungrateful for the people who ran out and bought my book. Just to be very, very clear, like, thank you so, so much. And I felt so loved and supported in that period of time. And it was invaluable to me from that perspective. But when people are like, oh, you're going to make money because your book's been banned, I just want to like shake them and be like, from who? Like it happens for like a second, but then that entire community, you just lost that whole market. And when you lose one group of kids, you lose every group of kids that they could have talked to about it as well. And this isn't really about the money, but for people who are interested in the money aspect of it, it doesn't help. Mm-mm. It doesn't help most people. Sure, Mouse got back on the New York Times bestseller list for a month because of this, and Genderqueer has remained in the public spotlight because of this.
But even Genderqueer sales numbers, I was reading a report on that, saw up like a 2-month bump and went right back down to normal levels.
Yeah, and was already kind of a bestseller in its category.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, and so like...
But also,
yes,
was never a kid's book.
Was also never a kid's
book. It was
book.
Always for adults.
Yeah, I know. It's a lot. It's hard to explain to people that like when you walk into a kid's library, Genderqueer isn't going to be shelved next to Everyone Poops. But both have been banned.
I'm running over time here, and I wanna be respectful of that. I do, before I let you go, I wanna ask, how are things on that podcast of yours?
It's so behind. We haven't
It's one of my favorite things.
Oh no, I'm so sorry.
I love it so much.
We're so behind. So like good news, bad news is I am in the National Leadership for Authors Against Book Bans, and I am like throwing myself against that wall. Like that is a huge amount of my time and effort and like labor these days. Is like I would say I'm full-time activisting, part-time authoring. Like, and the podcast has just kind of like gone to the side while that's going on, because it's hard to be like, but I have to yell into a microphone my opinions
about when I'm like Twilight.
About Twilight when I am like, you know, trying to get meetings with senators to force them to bring this stuff to the floor. So like, you know, it's been hard. We'll come back eventually. But if you haven't ever listened, I do co-host a very fun podcast called Failure to Adapt with my very good friend, Red Scott. He's a stand-up comedian and also just somebody who's really interested in sort of the technical aspects of filmmaking. And I'm obviously an author and a loudmouth and kind of a cunt. And so together we do this podcast that compares books to their film or TV adaptations. And it's very fun.
I'm excited. I'm excited for the day that you get to do an episode about your own story.
Girl, me too. We might die waiting for that.
Well, Maggie Takuta Hall, it is always a treat to get to be in conversation with you. If folks want to find you, your work, everything about you, where can they do that?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Blue Sky under Maggie Takuta Hall.
That's very easy.
My website, is prettyokmaggie.com. I don't update it very often.
I have to say, I did. My agent was like, Dawn, you have a lot coming out. You need an author website. So I hired somebody and I gave them your website. And I said, just make me that. But for me.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
Because I want to hire somebody to fix my website, Dawn. It's not a good website.
I will send you her info. She's great. She's like, I said, I just She's need this. Like, I just this need this, but with this? My face on it, please.
Scrub the serial numbers off. Change the book covers.
Yep. Yeah. I was like, this is simple. It's easy. I know exactly where to click.
Yeah.
I can do many things. I am not in my MySpace era learning to code just so that I can put like a Jean Grey wallpaper and like an Evanescence song.
You are the official TikToker of AABB, so
the hair model.
You got that going for you.
I saw that email where you called me a hair model. I can't believe
you are
it.
A hair model. Your hair is beautiful.
Thank you so much. Oh, come on. This says you. Says you.
All hair is beautiful, but especially ours. Anyway.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Maggie Takuda Hall, for kicking off Pride Month with me. Make sure to go pick up her new book, The Worst Ronin, wherever fine books are sold. Now, here's the thing. If you like the show and you want to support it, it's Pride Month. And if you don't, it's homophobic, right? Okay, so make sure to go tell a friend that you love this show, right? Or else you're homophobic. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. You're not homophobic if you don't tell somebody that you like this show. I just have to say that so that I can guilt you into like telling people about the show. Okay, so it's a bit. It's a bit. Anyways, so you're homophobic if you don't tell your friends about the show, or if you don't go rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and while you're there, consider leaving a review, because reviews help other listeners discover the show that are just like you. Whatever shows you like, it's going to go tell the algorithm, hey, other people might like this show too. Now, listen here, all of those are free ways that you can tell people about the show, but if you have some scratch, some coin, some currency of the realm, you could give a little bit of that to me to help continue making this show at patreon.com/headonfirepod. You get everything for as little as $1 a month, or you could pay in advance for like a year at $1 a month, or whatever you can. If you can give a little more, you can give a little more. But you can get early access to ad-free episodes, full-length episodes, audio, video, archived stuff from back when this show was called something else. All of that is available to you and everybody who subscribes, patreon.com/headonfirepod. Now, if you want to connect with me on social media, I am at Head on Fire Pod on all forms of social media, whether I want to be or not. Yay. Anyways, I'm going to let you go. Happy Pride Month. Stay safe. Stay blessed. And remember to never stop seeking illumination, like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well and happy Pride.